Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. What connects a wildlife photographer with an animal is very often just the camera. But for Jocelyn Kagan, it's also the moment. The moment, she says, when emotion and intellect come together. She says, when the photographer in me meets intelligence on the other side of the lens, which in her particular case is the highly endangered African wild dog, or painted dog, or even painted wolves, as they've sometimes been called. But let's track back a little bit, because Kagan herself wears a number of hats. She's been a speech and drama teacher, a business management coach, a neuro-linguistic programming practitioner. She's authored several books. So I wonder to myself, how come she's produced a huge glossy title on Africa's wild dogs, which is subtitled A Survival Story, on account of the fact that these creatures are so very endangered. She's also founded a fund for their survival. Well, Jocelyn, you've been very busy with African wild dogs for some time, and I believe that the story began back in 2010 when you were really got involved with the wild dogs. But let's just be clear about this title, African wild dog, sometimes called the painted dog, sometimes called the painted wolf. Just explain to us.
Yes, my story started in 2010. I was in Botswana, and I was on a photographic safari with friends. And the next thing, this animal went shooting across in front of the vehicle, and I had never seen it before. And of course, if you see something new in the bush, it is so exciting. I was like looking at this animal, I thought, I haven't seen anything as beautiful as this for a long time in the bush. Its painterly coats, its huge ears, its long, elegant legs. And we tracked with the African wild dog. We raced along with it. We wundubashed, in other words, went over bushes, and eventually caught up with it after it made a kill. And there I was watching this animal strip the flesh from the skeleton. And then it gave this call, being a woo, woo call, quite soft and to the ground. And that was to attract those members of the pack who had gone off in an opposite direction. I was totally intrigued by these animals, but it wasn't until 2015 that I really got interested. And that's when I started to delve into the name of the dog. It's known as a dog or a wolf. Now, to a large degree, the name wolf is like cosmetic overtone. The animal originated from the gray wolf. But 1.7 million years ago, the African wild dog started to adapt. And it has adapted distinctly away from its original ancestor. So to call it a wolf in today's terms is really, to me, not acceptable. Also, a lot of research has been done into the name. It's been called the Cape hunting dog. The hunting dog, it's got a plethora of names. And in each case, they come back to, or people who are examining the name of this animal comes back to either African wild dog or painted dog. Now, the painted dog is a recent naming. It was started in Zimbabwe by Eric Rasmussen, and it was to appease the concept that this dog-like animal should be associated with a wolf. He had an understanding that there was a negative connotation to the word wolf. And in terms of analyzing the names, yes, that's exactly what's come out, is that wolf has a more negative connotation for this particular animal. But I think we're looking at genetics, we're looking at paleontological findings, and I think this argument is starting to hold firm that this animal is uniquely African. Its adaptations are unique to it as a canid and as an animal. And I think this is something that we as South Africans can be extremely proud of, because we have the main body of these predators remaining out of the 6,500 that are left in Africa. South Africa has about 550 spread between the Kruger National Park and up in KwaZulu-Natal. And then Botswana has quite a large family of, or number of families of African wild dogs. And then, of course, Tanzania's got dogs, Kenya. So there are dogs spread out, but the main holding of these dogs are here in South Africa. And I think as in very recent times, in fact, in the last 20, 25 years, most of the research on the dog started to come through. And we're seeing more and more just what an extraordinary animal this actually is.
I think that we should not be so very proud here in South Africa of the fact that we have so few, 550 odd, it seems like a tiny little figure. But before we get on to how very threatened it is, can we just stay with the name for a bit, the painted bit, which is so appealing, you know, a creature that's called a painted dog. Sounds fabulous, but it is because they have this sort of mottled fur, and each one is very different.
Their paintedly design in black, tan and white is apparently to do with their amino acid mix. Each animal has its own distinctive patterning, which means as a researcher, you can go out there, photograph them, and you'll always know which, and then, of course, give it a name. Thank goodness we've moved away from numbers. Animals used to be given numbers in research. Now they're given names amongst a number of researchers, and that idea is still growing. So you can go out, you can identify them. And what's very interesting about their coat is that they start to lose their fur. They don't have an undercoat. They just have a single coat. And when they start to age, they start to lose it, but the pattern stays on the skin. So that's very, very interesting. And, of course, then you look at the colouring of their tails. They have these huge, bushy, white tails, and the tip is often white. So there's a mottled, there's a brown or tan colour in the tail and then the white tip. Now, some of the dogs have black tips. Also, the intensity of colour changes. They are darker on East Coast, the East Coast dogs in Kenya and Tanzania. Some of those dogs are a lot darker. So there seems to be some kind of variation going, but the basic patterning is exactly the same. And when I say basic patterning, the basic cause of the patterning is the same.
Yes. Because each and every one is different. Yes. And you have most certainly, looking through your book, you have certainly got to know each and every one of the creatures that you've taken photographs of. When I say intimately, really quite intimately, because you spent so long actually gazing at them. But let's come back to the paucity, the scarcity of these animals. Why are there so few? I mean, I imagine that there were numbers teeming across the veld many years ago. Have they been, it has to be said that they don't have such a good press because of their apparently aggressive habits. But why are there so very few? Have they been hunted out? What's
they
the story?
They have. They haven't been hunted, they've been persecuted. And there's a big difference between that. In the turn of the century, turn of the 1900s, the great white hunters, as they were called, came out from America and from England and from Europe, and they came into Africa and they saw Africa was teeming with game. And they took possession of that. They saw somehow in their own minds, they decided this was theirs. And the packs of dogs need to hunt twice a day to feed themselves, the adults, and to feed their pups. And I do want to speak about their social structures. And these hunters, of course, brought with them, they had farmers, there were farmers in the area that came in with them, and the farmers had sheep and goats. Well, you know, if a goat is standing there just munching away, and a pack of wild dogs come past, and the goat offers little resistance, of course they're going to take out the goat. Well, the farmers got upset, and there was one, C.W. Morne. He was definitely one of the leaders of the Great White Hunters, and he was published, and he was very, very vocal. And he took a dislike to the dogs. Well, it's said that he went into the bush, well, into the Kenyan bush with crystal and white tablecloths, and he saw these dogs disemboweling their prey. And he took umbrage. How could a dog have such bad table manners? And he actually spread the word that these dogs should be classified as vermin. And at that time, leopard and cheetah were also classified as vermin. Also because they took out the prey that the hunters were after. So we see this starting to happen and we see this progressing. towards the dogs, it became even more vicious, because what these people would do, the farmers especially, they would track to the dogs when they were denning. The dogs den for 3 months. They are easy sitting targets. They would blow up the dens. They'd kill the adults. The way the dogs were treated is absolutely appalling and nauseating to me and to many. And very quickly started to eradicate the dogs. Up until the mid-70s in Zimbabwe, anybody who brought in the tail of a wild dog was given 5 shillings. So we see that this persecution has been happening right up until our recent time. The dogs are on the endangered wildlife list, on the red list, because of their low numbers. What I would ultimately like to see is that the dogs are protected. We also have situations in South Africa where farmers are fed up. They do not support the conservation of the dogs, and they will shoot dogs. We have this on record. And of course, it's a small animal. It's a small animal compared to the herbivores, and it's easy to bury them. And nobody would know, except that now even the free-ranging packs of wild dogs in the Waterberg are being collared. And we are tracking, when I say we, it's my identification with the enormous number of people working with wild dogs through Wildlife Act, very, very active in conservation to do with the wild dogs. WAG, Wild Dog Advisory Group, they are a voluntary group of scientists, conservationists. The chairperson is Harriet Davis Mostard, and she's been tracking and developing WAG for the last 20 years, and just slowly people have been gravitating towards her. Now it's taking that quantum leap forward. Now we are getting all sorts of wonderful research coming through about the wild dog. Also in the last 25 years, that research has been coming through showing what an extraordinary animal this is. And no, it shouldn't be hunted out. It shouldn't be, the dens should not be blown up, but we should actually grow the populations. And Wild Dog Advisory Group is very active, again with the Endangered Wildlife Trust, in growing the packs and finding sustainable environments for the packs to go into. And that's where cooperation between, for example, Wildlife Act and the Bataleers. Now, the Bataleers are voluntary pilots with farmers who will lend their planes to come in and fly the dogs to new locations. So when a new pack has been bomed, they have bonded, they're a happy family, they will be then transported to an area which has been sourced for them, which is sustainable that it's got enough game, that the game are growing. And this is very important, that the predator balance is kept in place, where you have a balance between the number of lions and hyena. Both of the natural enemies of the wild dog are enough for the dogs to be able to cope with, because one clap from a lion and a dog is dead. The hyenas are thieves. They like to steal the dog's kill. And the dogs are 80% successful with their kills. They are the most successful of all the predators, and far more successful than the hyena. The hyena's lazy and they drool. I don't like them, but that's my personal opinion. But other people love hyena, and that's great. Yeah. Somebody's got to love them.
Well, your personal opinion, your personal research is really what's important here, because clearly you've done a great deal of work, not just looking at them, but researching their whole history, how they behave more than anything. And as somebody who studies, has made a study as a teacher, as a mentor, as a neuro-linguistic programming practitioner, you've done a lot of studying around people. And one thing you said earlier there was, when they are a happy family, and it seems that they are a very family-minded species, I suppose not unlike the elephant. Just describe to us a little bit about their social habits.
Very much like the elephant, where in the elephants you've got the matriarch, with the wild dogs you've got the alpha male and the alpha female, but it's the alpha female who runs the pack. She is an extraordinary animal. She determines which den to use, and invariably she'll go back to a maternal den. That, again, made it easy for the farmers to track them. So she and the alpha male will be the only two in the pack who mate. That's been traditional. If a sub-female mates and shouldn't, that sub-female is putting herself up for a huge amount of problems, because if the alpha female is of the vicious nature, she will actually kill the pups of the sub-female. She'll also not allow the pack to feed the sub-female, and it makes it very, very difficult for the sub-female. If a female wants to mate, what you find is that after a year or two, when she is a yearling or she's 2 years old, she and possibly a sister and maybe a brother will leave the pack, and they'll set up their own pack. They'll go looking for mates, and they'll set up their own pack. And somehow they will eventually, an alpha female will emerge and an alpha male will emerge from the breakaway pack, and they will get on with it. Let's return to the pack that we're talking about. The photographs in the book, which makes a fantastic Christmas present. I have to bring that in. We're talking about families and making people feel really good. Yeah. And that's what the dogs do. So in the book, you'll see two photographs, and I was extraordinarily fortunate to be there at the time when the pups came out of the den for the very first time. And Violet, the mum, her story is really interesting. Her mother had been killed just before mating season started. So her father was the alpha male. It got close to the mating season. The pack knows that unless a litter is born, their survival is threatened as a pack because their numbers will not grow. As it is, only 50% of a litter survives, if that. So Alva, there was a mating between her father and Violet herself. She was 2 years old. And just before she was about to den, her father was killed by a hyena. That left a two-year-old pregnant to run the pack, which she's done extremely successfully. She is in menopause, by the way. And I got there just when the pups were a month old. And it's when a month old that they start to creep out of the den. And the pack is there. The family are standing around so excited to meet these babies. They will stand around the mouth of the den, and you can hear the squeaks coming out of the den. It is the most endearing sound to hear and to see that interaction. And that's where my neurolinguistics comes in, because I'm not only watching the big movement, but I'm watching the tiny movements. And when this little mite crept over the lip of the den, these adults formed a little family portrait, which I have in the book. So fortunate to get that. And they licked and touched with such endearment, welcomed this little creature to their world. Now they will take care of this, of the babies. There were five. 2 years later, there's only one left out of the five. But they will go off hunting. They will come back. They'll regurgitate the food for the mum. And once the pups start to feed, after about 14 days to a month, they start to get weaned, and then they start to eat meat. And they're very funny. They play with the food. And whatever the adult has regurgitated and they don't eat, the adult will re-eat, because food is food. And the pups are really quite sweet. Extraordinarily sweet and endearing, and they play all sorts of games. And the one thing that the wild dog does, which most other predators don't do, and that is play right through their lives. And that playing, I think, is part of their training for their successful strategic hunting strategies. Because I saw this with the pups when they were 3 months old. The one would pick up a twig. The other would, the eye contact is very quick. Again, my NLP coming in. What are they looking at? What are they seeing? And you could see the expressions change on the face of the one without the twig. And he said, I want that. And he would immediately charge the one with the twig. And this is the way they will then play. They'll rough and tumble. They will race one after the other. They'll pull on their ears, they'll catch each other by the necks, just the way our domestic dogs play. And we know what our domestic dogs are like when they're two or three in a home. They all want the same toy, just like children.
Well, my goodness me, you certainly have got very involved with this particular family. Violet, I'm thinking about the matriarch Violet. I love that name. Do you want to tell us why she's called Violet?
Nick Murray named her Violet.
Violet, yes. So Violet, she remains.
Yes, yes.
So, very happy family. You describe them at play, having fun together, but unlike the domestic dog who's going to have his biscuits and his tin of whatever it is to eat, or he, she, they are hunting dogs. Yes. And this is where the other side of that happy family comes into play. Just describe, because I think one of the reasons that they've been persecuted by people who know less about them, they're such aggressive hunters. Just describe how they hunt.
Thank you, Nancy. That opens a wonderful opportunity for me to explain this. You're seeing animals in the wild, they all have a plus side and a minus side. The way we as humans will judge. So let's remove that judgment and just let's look at the total animal. They have this fantastic social bonding. They care enormously for their pups, their future, and then they need to eat. So being carnivores, and they are hypercarnivores because they don't eat leaves. If driven, they'll eat a bird. But that's still being a carnivore. As I said, they don't eat berries. They don't eat leaves. So they're not into vegetation. And they are not scavengers. They won't eat something that somebody else has killed. So they won't go and feed off an elephant carcass, for example. So they have to hunt. I suspect that part of their digestion that starts to work is the excitement of the hunt. But nobody's scientifically proven that. It's kind of difficult to prove that. I mean, you've got to kill the animal or to measure what the acid levels are in the stomach when you're going hunting. And that's going to be very difficult to do. But anyway, so the animals they are actually the cleaners of the environment because they will take out injured animals, they'll take out the young who are weak, and they'll take out the old. They'll go for herbivores that are of a medium size. And what that does, it also gives the plants a chance to regrow, and they are not decimated by overpopulation of herbivores. The dogs perform a very important service to an environment and to the ecology. So they'll wake up, they'll go off on a hunt, they'll search, they'll find a herd of, for example, impala, they'll spot the animal that they want, and then they'll start to run. And yes, they do run, they chase. It was thought that they tire the animal out. It is and it isn't. Yes, the animal does get tired, but the wild dog does not just chase it. It comes in from a left side. It'll come in from the right side. They take over from one another. So it's almost like a relay of the dogs outpacing the prey. They bring their prey down, and immediately, and this is the part that really nauseates a lot of people, immediately start feeding. What is supposed that happens is that the animal goes into an enormous state of shock and the adrenaline starts to pump through and they supposedly don't feel. That's an argument that one can have with no end. The dogs take what they can, they strip the carcass, and they have to eat really fast. Now, nature has provided them not only with this hunting technique, but also with legs that are with muscles, additional muscles in their legs that enable them to run this long distance, and also their teeth. They have these carnassial teeth, which when they rub up against each other, sharpen each other, and they are able to strip the carcass very quickly. They have to do this because behind them come hyena, and hyena will chase the dogs off their kill. If there's one hyena, as you'll see in the book, a hyena getting its bottom bitten by the dogs, it's chanced it. The dogs had actually finished eating. There were just two nibbling on the carcass that was left, and the hyena chanced it and got away with the remains, but not before it got its bum bitten. So I felt very pleased with the dogs being effective as far as that was concerned. But again, if a lion comes along, the dogs leave the they leave the kill immediately. They know who they can argue with and who they can't. They're highly, highly, highly intelligent animals.
Yeah, yeah. Your involvement with them is phenomenal. It's been over, well, since we've been 10 years, really, hasn't it?
I actually didn't really get that involved with them in the period between 2010 and 2015. It was in 2015 that I really started getting involved with them. And that was as a result of the photograph on the cover of the book. I was in Manapools in Zimbabwe, and it was early morning, lying in the dirt with pebbles pushing into my knees and into my elbows, with my camera balanced on, my lens balanced on a rock. And these three pups came up. They broke away from the family of 24 at that time. And these three or four pups came closer and closer and then sat down to look at us and to find out who we are. And he looked into the lens, and that was love. What can I say?
It is, your book is it's a story of survival, but it's also a love story, because you have fallen head over heels in love with this, with the whole species. But, you know, as you describe the lying in the dirt with your camera balanced on a rock, I'm thinking, yuck, this is not an easy job. And I, as far as I know, I'm sure there are many wildlife women wildlife photographers, but maybe not so many published wildlife women photographers. How punishing is it to be a wildlife photographer? I mean, as a woman, do you feel endangered as you're shooting?
Not the wild dogs. I don't personally feel endangered, but certainly one has to take precautions. In most of the reserves, I was very fortunate to go to Manapools, where you're allowed out of the vehicle, and so I could get out and I could get low on the ground. One always has a guide with one who's armed in the event of anything untowards happening. But again, as a wildlife photographer, I certainly promote being respectful of the animal. One doesn't get too close. One uses the lens, and one uses a long lens to bring it in that intimacy. But if one's photographing lions or leopard or cheetah, the leopard and the cheetah most probably would run away because they're quite skittish, but not lions. So one's always respectful, and one's respectful of elephants, especially elephants, just because of their greatness. And one can't trust that they're going to like you because you think you're an elephant-loving animal. So again, it depends on where you are, but it is not safe. There are many excellent, excellent wildlife photographers, women wildlife photographers. Very few are published, which I find extraordinary. But at the same time, I can understand it, that it is not a very safe environment, and it is grueling. And one is up pre-dawn, one is out, one comes back late. There's a snatch of an opportunity to have a bite to eat, to download the morning's shooting, and then to go out again until after dark. And then sometimes, if you're on a shoot with a professional team, you are then shooting way into the night with infrared cameras and things like that. But yeah, it's a challenging environment to be in as a woman.
Well, it seems that love conquers all. As long as you can run fast, I'm sure you're okay. But just in closing, Quo Vadis, where are we going with this? I mean, the numbers of African wild dogs here in South Africa, 550, I think you said. Shameful number. How do you anticipate that the numbers can grow? Can they be kept in captivity? Can they be bred safely? What's the future?
The future is the range expansion program, which WAG is promoting, and Endangered Wildlife Trust, as I explained earlier. WAG is going out into Mozambique, into Malawi, into various other countries within Africa to see where there are sustainable reserves for the dogs. And that is where the range expansion program is going to put the dogs back into the wild. So zoos, I am very, very concerned about zoos and wild dogs and all other animals. I'm concerned about the number of reserves that take wild dogs. Many reserves are reluctant, even though they would be sustainable, they're reluctant to take the wild dogs because the wild dogs are maintenance. They're cunning. they are tenacious, and they like to, unless there's a predator fence, the dogs will get out. And I just want to mention something about that. Peter Apps, and in my book, I've included a number of scientists, and they were fantastic. They came on board and wrote articles about what they had observed in the dogs. And Peter Apps is working with the Botswana Predator Conservation Trust, and he is developing a spray which can be sprayed around the border, which matches the wild dog marking territory spray. And the idea is ultimately to spray around the borders of a reserve to keep the dogs inside, because they'll smell the scent and realize that, or think that there is a pack in the area, and so they won't go into that area. They'll stay in their own area. And so he's busy working on that. The article in the book by Harriet Davis-Mostert about the range expansion program, and that also by Dr. Dave Drews from KZN Wild Dog Management Group, they both of those explain in greater detail about the range expansion program. And that is how we're going to keep the dogs growing. We can't get them back to the original numbers that they were, the teaming numbers, because of sustainability. What we really need to do is support Africa's Wild Dog Survival Fund. My intention is to support with that money. I've already started paying out to these various organizations represented in my book, because they're doing work directly with the dogs. So yes, we are another channel for fundraising. And I think this is really important. Just to give you an idea of the costs incurred, I said earlier that the packs are all being collared. A collar can cost anything from 35,000 rand up. And that means it is a collar, it's got to be monitored, it's a satellite link to a computer. If the dogs are in trouble, an immediate alert can go out, a dog can be saved. For example, dogs are caught in snaring, and Rosemary Groom from Zimbabwe, in her organization, they are working very closely with their communities with dogs that have been snared. And snaring is awful. Dogs will chew off their own legs to get out of a snare. So we really do need to support Rosemary to set up her her anti-snaring unit. Again, that's where the money's going. So to all of you listeners, whatever you can donate, we really would appreciate making
well,
that appeal.
Well, I think first prize is to buy your beautiful book, because you'll get a whole lot. Not just will you be supporting the fund, but it will be a complete education. The photographs are absolutely beautiful. Jocelyn, thank you very much. So just to recap, I think the book itself is published by Marlin Unwin in the UK, but it's distributed here in South Africa by Strake. So if anybody would like to get hold of a copy, I think it's also available on Amazon, which is good news. So if anybody would like simply to go to a website and donate some money directly, www.kagan.co.za,
and you'll find a portal there.
www.kagan.co.za.
Yes.
Jocelyn, bless you. And all your wild animals, who I feel sure you've adopted into your very own. You are the matriarch.
Thanks so much, Nancy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.